Welcome to the Ohio Star Podcast. I am your host, Neil W. McCabe, the national political editor of the Star News Network, a constellation of 11 state-focused news sites that includes the Ohio Star. In this episode of the Ohio Star Podcast, you will hear from Star reporter Peter Debraska, who will talk to me about what he is covering in Ohio and what other stories he is working on. Next up, we hear from Jim Burgess, a member of the Ohio Republican Party Central Committee's Financial Review Committee. Burgess is a data systems business analyst and consultant, and he explained the questions that he emailed to party treasurer David W. Johnson. By way of background, the Ohio Republican Party's chairman, Robert Paduchek, and Johnson have not been able to explain why there is up to $3 million unaccountable in the financial records of the Ohio Republican Party. And they are the target of a lawsuit filed by five members of the Central Committee, led by Mark Bainbridge. Bainbridge is a certified public accountant, and he retired as a partner after a three-decade-long career at Ernst & Young. Burgess is not part of that lawsuit, but he is very much in league with the members of the Ohio Republican Party Central Committee who are trying to reform how the party operates. And by that I mean, they are not part of the 15 or so members of the committee who enjoy payroll for PAL hookups from Governor Mike DeWine and the party. Next, you'll hear my conversation with Georgia Republican Congressman Jody Heiss about his challenge to the Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, in the Republican primary. Raffensperger is the man who oversaw the handling of Georgia's 2020 election and backed the certification of the 2020 election. But first, let's kick this thing off with my conversation with Star reporter Peter Debraska.
Peter, how's it going?
Neil, it's going well. It's good to be here. How are you?
Fantastic to talk to you again. You've been doing some great work, obviously, for the Ohio Star and other places. And I think one of the biggest stories in modern Ohio history is something they said could never be done. They passed constitutional carry, and DeWine says he's going to sign it, or he has already signed it. What is your characterization of DeWine as a Second Amendment governor, and how are things changing in Ohio?
Well, it's interesting. You know, this Governor DeWine, he signed the constitutional carry bill on Monday night. He's been sort of, I would say, atypically conservative on this. I mean, you always kind of think of Governor DeWine, at least I do, as sort of a squishy, moderate, middle-of-the-road Republican, but constitutional carry is a massive win, and it's the second major gun control, gun rights legislation that he's passed, or that he's signed, in the past year. So, you know, about a year ago, Ohio passed this Stand Your Ground law, which Governor DeWine signed into law, which says, you know, you have no duty to retreat. If somebody attacks you, you can simply defend yourself with a weapon. And now we have constitutional carry, which, of course, offers far fewer restrictions on how you can carry a gun, and pushes us back towards the Second Amendment in its purer form. You know, it's been eroded over time, just by Democrats and lobbying groups and everybody who thinks that magically, if you take guns out of the hands of responsible citizens, that somehow irresponsible citizens won't get them. Right?
Yeah, well, I think what's going to happen is in these neighborhoods where the police have basically abandoned these places, I think in the old days we used to say ghettos, but barrios or some of these neighborhoods that, you know, there is no law enforcement, and basically the only people who are armed are the people who ignore the law. So I'm thinking about places in Cleveland. I'm thinking of places like in Akron. Even places in Cincinnati where, you know, it's like the Wild West out there. And these gun laws disarm the law-abiding citizen, but there's no gangbanger. There's no terrorist who fills out like a background check and says, yes, alias, the Jackal. You know, are you a convicted felon? Well, I'm wanted in 10 countries. You know, with 20 different warrants, Interpol is after me. Like, nobody does that. And so when the left says, you know, there's going to be a bloodbath, and the left says, you know, you want more school shootings, that's actually not what's going to happen, because people who carry concealed, they're like shepherds amongst us. And these are people who have taken a responsibility for the community, not just to protect themselves, their family, and their businesses, and their homes, but they're actually looking out for all of us. And so when there are people walking concealed in a mall or in a city, you know, mm-hmm. they're like, and it's like, you know, the cops are going to be at that. If there's a church shooting, the cops are going to be there 15 minutes, like, best case scenario.
Too late. Yeah, 15 minutes too late every time.
Meanwhile, you know, how many times have we heard, you know, it's like, you know, gunman comes into a church, gunman comes into a restaurant, store, right? Someone who's carrying concealed takes them down in 15 to 20 seconds. Right. And they have all of these, statistics about, you know, crimes involving guns. There's no way to measure the millions of crimes in this country every year that are prevented because someone is carrying, and because people are concerned that people in that town are carrying. And believe me, there are places in Texas where you don't break into a house.
That's right. Well, and so, you know, what's particularly interesting, I think, about this concealed carry bill or constitutional carry bill, it's like, it's not extremely radical. It's not like it's a massive change in gun laws. All it basically says is you don't have to have a license anymore in order to conceal a weapon. So, you know, if you're above age 21 and you can otherwise legally own a weapon, you simply don't have to go and sit through 8 hours of class and get a little permit from the government that says, hey, I have permission to carry a weapon concealed. You know, the other thing it does is it loosens restrictions on what duties you have to inform a peace officer that you're carrying a weapon. So currently, not currently anymore, but before, if you had a weapon concealed in like a car or on your person, and you came in contact with a police officer or any other kind of peace officer, you were required to inform them that you were concealing a weapon. If you didn't, that was a felony, so punishable by 1 year or more in jail. If you, and by the way, you could have your license revoked for a period of time. This bill doesn't eliminate the duty to inform. It simply makes it less of a penalty if you don't inform. So it's like a misdemeanor, probably like a fine or something like that. And
The reality of that law is that a lot of times what happens is they pull you over and they search you for like drugs or whatever, your car, whatever. And then, you know, they find that you don't have any drugs and you didn't do anything illegal, but we found a gun that you didn't tell us about. And so now we've bagged you, even though the gun had nothing to do with the stop. And even though the gun was in the trunk. And so a lot of times there was a lot of people who were sort of caught up on that end of it. And I'm glad I think that people should, in all normal circumstances, all things being equal, you should be telling the cop, by the way, I have a gun with me. But there may be some circumstances where you forget or you don't. And it's like, I don't want to see somebody go to jail because they were pulled over for speeding and the guy just wants to ring up the tape.
Sure. And, you know, I think that most law-abiding gun owners automatically will inform police, you know, every single time. And you know, probably will continue to do so, right? They're not going to say, well, it's only a misdemeanor now, so I think we're going to go ahead and break the law, right? And once again, we're talking about responsible gun owners here. So I mean, all in all, massive Second Amendment wins in Ohio. Go Ohio. You're paving the way for other states to pass similar laws and to restore the Second Amendment.
Well, Pete, I just spent a week in Georgia, and I spoke to Jody Heiss, the congressman, Republican congressman who's running against Raffensperger in the Republican primary for Secretary of State. And that interview is going to be a part of this podcast. So folks, stay tuned to that. The idea that Joe Biden got 10 or 12 million votes more than Barack Obama did in 2012 is absurd. Like, I wasn't living in a country that where 10 million more people voted for Biden than voted for Obama.
Oh, that's crazy. And so Trump actually broke his own record for most votes ever, which he set in 2016. He broke his own record in 2020, and then Joe Biden broke that record on top of it. I mean, it's just the whole thing is just – that is flatly absurd, and nobody's ever going to explain how that happened. And so, you know, I think that the drum that we should continue beating, like, just the absurdity of the number in itself. And so, you know, they dug this guy up out of a morgue. He couldn't get anybody to go to any rallies, and 12 people sitting around honking horns, congrats, right? Enthusiasm for Trump's at an all-time high. Everything's going great. And then all of a sudden, boom, you get Biden. And we've seen what's happened since then. We're only going downhill. And by the way, relating back to this Georgia story, they're setting up to do it again. I mean, that's the plan here. It's quite obvious. The only way they can win anything in 2022 is to cheat. I mean, they're going to get hammered otherwise. So,
what was Stacey Abrams' connection with those organizations?
Sure. So two of the organizations that are putting over $1 million or $1 million at least into fighting these election integrity law are Fair Fight Action, which Stacey Abrams herself founded in 2014, and then the New Georgia Project, which Stacey Abrams formerly was the CEO of. And so essentially what you're going to have here is nonprofits working on Stacey Abrams' behalf, nonprofits that Stacey Abrams is intimately familiar with, working on her behalf and spending millions of dollars on her behalf, de facto on her behalf, in order to help her beat Brian Kemp. Now, you know, in my opinion, that should be illegal. It's already illegal for nonprofits to contribute to causes, to partisan causes, right? This is like almost a loophole to get around that. And so, you know, like I said, they're setting us up once again I don't want to go out on a limb and say that like they're going to cheat again, but this in itself is shady enough. Of course, in 2020, Zuckerberg funneled, what was it, like $420 million or something into nonprofits around the country. And those nonprofits use that money.
Yeah.
Particularly in swing states, to like buy, you know, mail-in ballot drop boxes and so forth, all of which, of course, is illegal.
Zuckerberg. What Zuckerberg did that is illegal and unconstitutional is that the government is supposed to run run the elections. But because of the 14th Amendment, equal protection under the law, I can't have my government do anything to increase votes in neighborhood A and ignore neighborhood B.
True.
It has to be the – so my encouragement of the vote cannot be bias.
Right.
What Zuckerberg did is he gave grants to government agencies and counties and basically picked up the payroll for them to hire all their left-wing buddies. And then they made sure all the drop boxes – were in the Democratic districts and precincts. And so he, in effect, put his thumb on the scale. So it was like, so to answer the constitutional question, he's like, oh, no, this is a private group. We just love votes and we just want to encourage voting. But that dodge falls apart when you realize that he was, in effect, hiring these government agencies to be his like private agency. Like he was,
right.
It wasn't like he hired a consulting firm. Like a lot of places will hire somebody to like hire a company and they'll go around and collecting signatures for you. Right. You're not supposed to be able to hire a county.
Right.
That's
right.
Maybe
so actually,
that's why it costs. And it costs a lot of money. No, like Zuckerberg has the money where he can buy 3 or 4 counties.
Sure.
Like, you know,
it's a rounding error for him.
Exactly.
And so if you're wondering who your real president is, right, look no further. You know, the problem really, the overarching problem is there's no nuance in politics anymore, right? That's just the way it is. So people aren't having nuanced debates. And so when you get into the weeds and you say, well, you know, if you look at the way these votes were counted in Antrim County, Michigan, you know, by the ballot scanners, and when you get into the weeds like that, people just they tune you out, and the left goes, oh, well, you can't prove that, right? So I think the most provable thing here is simply the fact that Joe Biden did not get 81 million legitimate votes, and you'll never convince me that he did. And by the way, all of the protesting of the 2020 election is an expression of that very basic belief. Right. And so, you know, Republicans might throw out these theories and say, well, this is what happened. But really, they're all a simple expression of that basic belief that Joe Biden couldn't possibly have gotten 81 million votes.
Well, you know, Andrew Jackson was he was jobbed in the election of 1824. And I believe that's right. It was either 24 or 28. And he spent the next 4 years saying he was robbed. And he was able to ride that into the White House. And I will point out that the Democrats challenged the legitimacy of the 68 election because they said Nixon did a secret deal with South Vietnam.
Sure.
The 72 election, of course, was with Watergate and the break-in, and supposedly that had something to do with Nixon winning 49 states. And they basically, you know, Nixon won 49 states, and less than 2 years later, he was railroaded out of town because of what the Democrats and their media allies were able to do. In 1980, they said that Reagan cut a secret deal with the Iranians, which was just like a copy and paste from what they said about Nixon in 68. In 84, they said there was no real hijinks, but they said it was like a bogus. They, you know, said that the Morning in America commercials were just, they said there was no mandate, but they didn't have any, there was no way someone was going to say that Reagan stole the election from Mondale. Like, nobody would go there. The next win for the Republicans was in, so then you had 92, where they said, okay, that was that, you know, Bush, George H.W. Bush legitimately won the election, but he did it by using Willie Horton and racism, which made it illegitimate. In 2000, of course, they said the thing was robbed in Florida. Right. In 2004, they said, wait for it, the Bush campaign manipulated the voting machines in Ohio. And Barbara Boxer objected to the Ohio slate of electors being certified, and the Democrats tried to decertify Ohio, which, you know, is the big lie, which is insurrection, which undermines our sacred institutions.
Right. To attack on democracy, for sure.
2016, they said, of course, that Trump was working for the Russians.
Right, yeah.
And so it's like, you know, basically in the post-New Deal era of American politics, every time a Republican wins, the Democrats will throw some charge on it to say that it was illegitimate. But nobody said Clinton stole his elections. Nobody said Carter stole his election. Nobody did that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, they're not mad about the questioning of the election results. They're mad about us finally fighting back. Right.
Yeah.
And that's seems to be the case.
Well, thank you, Peter, for coming on the Ohio Star podcast this week, and look forward to talking to you next week.
Likewise. Thanks, Neil.
Jim Burgess strikes me as a man not looking for trouble. I was at the February 18th meeting of the Ohio Republican Party Central Committee when party treasurer David W. Johnson gave his report, but did not explain to the committee members why the party was 3 weeks late filing one of its reports. And then he said he would only take questions by email, not at the meeting. So guess what? Burgess sent Johnson some questions by email. And Johnson, of course, ignored the email. So Burgess sent it again. And here's my conversation with Jim Burgess about the Ohio Republican Party and those questions he has for Johnson.
Jim Burgess, how are you? Thank you for joining the Ohio Star podcast.
Oh, hey, Neil. Happy to be talking to you today.
So Jim, just to establish your role in the Ohio Republican Party, are you still a member of the Financial Review Committee, or did you get bounced?
No, I am still a member. I have not. I was not inappropriately kicked off like a few other members have been.
How did that happen? I thought Paduchek was basically clearing the decks. Chairman Robert Paduchek. Go ahead, please.
I was not part of the lawsuit, so that wasn't a contributing factor. I had been part of. I went in with a couple of folks early on back in the chairman's initial days as chairman. Went in and we talked about some of the concerns that we had. I was part of that. I had also signed on to at least one of the letters, didn't get a chance to sign the second letter that we sent, letting the chairman know that we were not happy with him supporting candidates outside of the bylaws. He'd been providing finances and in-kind contributions to state-level candidates like the Governor DeWine and some other candidates against our bylaws. It wasn't approved as budgetary spending, and our bylaws state that it has to be a candidate endorsed for a race, whether it's a primary or general. You know, it doesn't really matter. But money had been donated, so we were mentioning concerns about that. But I didn't make it into the lawsuit, and so I think that's probably why I'm still a member of the committee.
Yeah, for now. So just so people have some context, we won't go back into like the deep dark history, but you know, on February 18th, the Central Committee of the Ohio Republican Party had its most recent meeting. The December meeting had ended sort of ingloriously, with Chairman Paduchek basically ramming through an adjournment while everybody was in a hallway during a recess, and then he just sort of rushed to the podium and got an adjournment done while everybody was like grabbing box lunches, only to find when they came back into the room, only to find out the meeting was over. Let me mention also that he also ordered sheriff's deputies to clear the public gallery. And he also adjourned the meeting before all the agenda items had been completed. But regardless, going forward to February 18th, the treasurer, David W. Johnson, gave his report. But he said he would not entertain questions from the Central Committee, that he would only entertain questions through staff by email. I know that's not the whole story, but did I get it straight?
In essence, that is true. The we had questions. You know, we hadn't seen the finances, but we knew a couple of things. You know, for instance, that the financial filings in the state of Ohio were late, so we knew those, and so we had some questions we were had prepared to ask, and then there were things we would have liked to have asked at that meeting, and then basically the treasurer's report was, here's the finances. They passed out the paper documents, and I could understand that if they didn't want the lawsuit complainants to be asking questions, but nobody else was able to entertain a question at the meeting at all. And so they basically said submit them in writing. And so I've been submitting a few.
How long have you been on the committee?
This has been 6 years, I believe. So I've had at least three terms.
So in the past, did treasurers just go up there and say, here's my report, and then email me if you have any questions, and then walk off?
Actually, some of the things that have happened, and then even Chairman Temkin was doing this a couple of days prior to the meeting. They would get the Financial Review Committee together just to review the reports. Chairman Pajuchik did that for, I believe, the May meeting for sure of 2021. And so we would have the opportunity as committee members, like Mr. Bainbridge or Mr. Bainbridge was on, and we could ask some questions and review them before before they got to the meetings. Although, you know, to the point that I've got a little bit of business finance background, it was phenomenal having Mr. Bainbridge on there with his CPA background. To really point out the issues with the finances, so it's been fantastic having his viewpoint there, and we've been able to support him. And you know, we can sit back, and I've gone and talked to other folks outside of the committee, and have to help understand some of the financial perspectives. But you know, we got a little bit of I don't know, time before the meeting, and then. You know, you didn't get enough time or the rest of the group, because there's, I don't know the number. There's just a few of us on the Financial Review Committee, but not all. And so they just rush through and people don't have time to digest the numbers and really ask pointed questions about what's going on.
And just to back up, it's Mark Bainbridge spent 3 decades at Ernst & Young, retired as a partner. He's now in private practice. Outside of Columbus, Ohio. He was on the Financial Review Committee before Pajuchik bounced him for asking too many questions, which is Bainbridge's story. Bainbridge told me himself that he was offered the opportunity to be on the Audit Committee, but he declined because when he took a look at the books, he felt that if he was on the Audit Committee, it would jeopardize his professional reputation and his license as a certified public accountant.
And I don't, you're right about his career. And he went to Chairman Temkin to talk about being on the Audit Committee and even, you know, having a specific role. And you're right, I don't blame him. I would be really concerned if I was somebody in the financial community with the way the finances look now. It should ruin your career if you're not doing anything about what's going on.
Yeah, and is it your understanding that the books are unauditable, which is Bainbridge's characterization?
They really, you know, I'm not that expert and that much of an expert. They really seem like it when you look at the review that they had done of the almost $640,000 of a receivable. It had a 100% error rate, and they couldn't account for $2,900 worth of it. So 100% unaudible, yeah. 90%, I wouldn't know. That'd be something that I would need somebody more with experience than I have to kind of tell you how close it is. But when they couldn't find the records for $2,900 out of 6,400 or 640,000, that tells you they're never going to get to 100%, which is not great.
Right. Now, the email you sent, it's I didn't add up these total. What is the total of these light items?
So the first email I sent out after the meeting was a question on the Ohio finance filings. So you're required as a PAC or a campaign, you know, whatever, to file financial filings. And there are state filings that go along with it. Well, first of all, they filed 24 days late. So they've broken the law, if you will. I don't know what the ramifications really are, but they were late 24 days for their main financial filing. One was done on time, and there's four of them. And the other two were with 23 days, somewhere in there. I have to go look. The second email, and so I asked about that, and they put the ownership on a consultant, which, you know, so much for the buck stops here kind of deal, because consultants don't get the fines. The Ohio Republican Party is going to get the fines if any are issued against them for late filings. But the second question I asked was about the $640,000 accounts receivable. That was the third. The second question was the details around the financial filings. If you go look at Mike DeWine's financial filing for the DeWine Husted campaign, and don't quote me on these numbers, they're estimates,
sort of ballpark, just so people get a flavor of the scale.
So they said that the Ohio Republican Party donated almost $500,000 or around $500,000 in in-kind contributions to the DeWine Husted campaign. The financial filing of the Ohio Republican Party, and this is for the second half of 2021. It wasn't the whole year, just the second half. The Ohio Republican Party submitted around $300,000. So there's a $200,000 discrepancy on the DeWine campaign. There's $100,000 on, is it the LaRoe? There's one of the other campaigns and about $50,000 discrepancy on the third one, all state level, Secretary of State, or Attorney General, those kinds of campaigns.
Right.
So in total, those three campaigns, the Ohio Republican Party was off just shy of $400,000 of matching, and they were under reporting. These three campaigns that I looked at stated almost $400,000 more than the Ohio Republican Party put on their records. So there are what it looks like to me, and that's the question I'm asking, is why is there a discrepancy? Why are we under-reporting?
Hold on, Jim. What's a few hundred thousand dollars between us? I almost expect somebody to say being in love is never having to say you're sorry. Like it's just a circus, and I cannot believe that this is like a first world country that has this thing. Like Ohio, it's not one of these new shabby states. Ohio is an old state. The Republican Party was founded in Ohio. Like it's like Ohio's had at least 17 or 18 presidents. Like Ohio. Ohio has football teams. It has Major League Baseball teams. It's a big red machine was in Ohio. Like how is it that Ohio could just who would even think they could get away with this, Jim?
You know, and it's been 2 weeks since I asked a question, and I resubmitted the question today. You know, there's not even validation or verification that they're looking into it. And this is not pointing out that funds are missing. It's bad financial records. The treasurer has been attacking those that have filed the lawsuit as frivolous. And he's saying his books are perfect and there's nothing missing, yet there is. Now, there is one record in the governor's filing of, it's around $10,000-$12,000. I can trace it back to a financial expense reported to, or is what it looks like. It's traced back to an expense in the Ohio Republican Party's filing, so they at least recorded the expense, but they didn't record that it was an in-kind donation. So either they need to go back to the governor and say, correct yours, or they need to correct their filings. That's all I'm asking. Why is there a difference of almost $400,000?
Okay, so let's just go down. I have the email in front of me, so let's just go down the list. DeWine Husted for Ohio reported in-kind contributions from the Ohio Republican Party of $520,784. Okay?
Right.
And is that the one that's a discrepancy, or I'll just go down the list? Is there anything special about that?
All three of those are a discrepancy. If you look at what the ORP did, I think it was around $300,000.
So then the Ohio Republican – okay, so you're saying is the Ohio Republican Party reported matching in-kind contributions to DeWine Husted for Ohio of $286,869. Okay, so that's the difference of what, 100?
I think it's in there $260,000, I think.
Yeah. So why did DeWine Husted, and of course Huston's a lieutenant governor, so this is they're running as a ticket. Why did DeWine Husted for Ohio campaign? Why did their campaign report 233,915 more than the Ohio Republican Party?
Correct. That's the question I'm asking. Because
okay,
the financial reports do not match up.
and I there was a lot of backing up, but there's just you know, you're conversing in this, and so I just saw that someone's just walking in the door into this madness that is the Ohio Republican Party finances. This is for the second 6 months of 2021. Now, in the February 18 meeting that we were talking about earlier, the committee voted to endorse DeWine, or basically a slate of all of the Republican incumbents for reelection, which included DeWine and Huston for governor, lieutenant governor, which then gives a legal fig leaf for the party then is authorized to make expenditures and resources and in-kind contributions and whatnot. But that was done in February. It wasn't done, you're talking about, in the 6 months previous, where there was no such authorization.
Correct. The Ohio Republican Party was fully within its rights at about 1 p.m. on Friday, February 18th, to start doing whatever kind of money they wanted, because there should be rules around it, that's the other thing. They didn't pass the rules around how they're supposed to handle contributions. But regardless of that, nothing should have been given to them per our bylaws prior to that February 18th date when they were finally given the permission to endorse.
Okay. So that brings us to David Yost for Ohio. And he is the Attorney General, correct?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And he reported in-kind contributions from the Ohio Republican Party of $137,532. Of course, so the Attorney General, right, the Chief Legal Officer of the state, his campaign received 137. He reported that he had received in-kind contributions of $137,532 illegally or inappropriately, like unauthorized. But he didn't return the money. But the Ohio Republican Party reported in-kind contributions to David Yost of $86,780. And so why did Yost report $50,752 more than the Ohio Republican Party?
Right. So two issues here. One is the appropriateness of timing of giving that, and that's not what I've been questioning, although we have, and we are fed up and kind of frustrated and sick in that it has happened outside of our bylaws. But this is about a treasurer saying, my books are perfect, and yet when I go review the data, you're off by 230,000, you're off by 50,000, you're off by another 100,000 when you get to, I believe, LaRose. And so how can the books be anywhere near, as you mentioned earlier, auditable if I can't even match, because I'm guessing that these three candidates that I've pointed out have done their financial filings properly. DeWine's been in this game way too long to make that mistake. And I think Houston and LaRose has as well. But either way, why are we reporting things differently, and why are our books so messed up that you can't make these even come close? Okay, you're off by, oh, we missed one. Okay, get it. But that's huge. The dollar amounts that they're off by are huge, and there's no answers at this point.
Right. These aren't like near misses.
Right. If on $530,000 there was a $10,000 issue, I could see that, because some of the things that they do run $10,000 to $12,000 at a pop. Oh, we missed one. But like I said, $230,000—that's a lot of entries that you're missing.
So even though the numbers aren't as big, probably the most egregious mistake belongs to the campaign of Keith Farber, who is the auditor, and friends of Farber reported in-kind contributions from the Ohio Republican Party of $105,699. The Ohio Republican Party only reported making in-kind contributions to Friends of Farber for a total of $555. Why did the Friends of Farber campaign report $44 more than the Ohio Republican Party. That's
right.
That's quite a swing and a miss.
Yeah. So let me, you know, issue my correction here. I've been saying LaRose. It is Faber. You're right. It was his. So I apologize for throwing Frank under that bus. But you're right. It's a 9,000% error rate or something like that. So it's Beth.
Did you ask Father or ask any of these guys?
No, I haven't because I think it's the job of the people of our guys. Because like I said, I can't imagine these guys being, you know, taking advantage and marking things inappropriately to those big of numbers. So I felt that those three campaigns have done the right thing and have filed their finances correctly. And so to me, I want, you know, the leadership, the employees that we hire to come back and say, we screwed up, or no, they really screwed up and we're on their case to get it fixed. I don't care either way, but there's a $400,000 discrepancy between these three campaigns. And that's huge. Somebody's books are really messed up. And from what I've been seeing, I totally believe it's ours. Totally.
Right, because it's not like they've demonstrated confidence, ethics, or even concern.
Correct. Exactly.
So has Johnson replied to you?
No, I've not received a response. Like I said, that specific issue, I asked the question 2 weeks ago today, and I resent them because I haven't received an answer from anybody. I resent that message today, asking them why I haven't received a response, and you know what's going on.
Can the financial review committee fire the treasurer?
No, that would really have to be an issue for the whole state central committee to take up at a meeting.
All right, let's just wrap this up because I know we've taken up a lot of time on this. It's fascinating to me that this whole thing is just bizarre that it's going on. It's just such third world stuff, and so has anybody put the touch on you to say, hey Jim, why don't you be a good time Charlie and go along to get along?
No, I haven't heard it. Actually, probably the more disappointing thing is outside of the few people that are concerned, you know, like those that are on the lawsuit and one or two other people, no one else has mentioned a word. No one's asked, yeah, hey, these are good questions. How come I haven't seen the answers yet? Out of 66 people, there's really only 10 to 12. That are really concerned, and it's just amazing that people aren't asking the same questions. You know, when are we going to hold people accountable? When are we going to get this stuff straight? You know, like I said, they received a report back in January that 100% of their accounting entries for a $640,000 receivable was done incorrectly, 100% of it. And I've asked that question as well, waiting for that answer. So why other people are not standing up and asking what's going on here is just disappointing. You know, we're supposed to be leaders. We're supposed to hold this organization accountable. We tried to not do it in the public. We tried to do it privately, and the leadership wouldn't take care of it privately. We didn't want to air dirty laundry, but if we've got to expose it to make something happen, that was kind of, that's why the lawsuit happened. But if 30 more members, if 10 more members, outside of the 12 to 15 of us that do care, would speak up, some action might actually happen. But that's what's really disappointing. So, you know, this election is a great time to look at the incumbents, see who's there, You know, they're running people against us that are swamp rhino creatures that aren't going to change the ball, and they're going to let this organization, you know, wander in the swallow that it's in. So now's the time to pay attention and really focus and do something about it.
Yeah. So before we wrap up, Jim, where is your district, and how would you characterize your professional non-Republican Central Committee life?
So I'm in the Franklin County, kind of the north east Columbus area. We're still still under review, but right now I'm my new district will be in there, and so we're waiting for those things to shake out and
right, because the central committee, the central, like a lot of states, the central committee seats are lined up with state senate seats.
Correct. So whatever the state senate lines that are finally finalized from the new maps, that's where the lines for the central committee people will be, and there is a male and female that gets elected for each seat in each district. So that's where that kind of lines up, and so we're waiting for the final answer on that.
Okay.
As far as career goes,
what do you do when you're not causing trouble in the Republican Party?
I'm a business systems guy. I've managed data quality teams for companies like IBM, Ashland, and Valvoline. Most recent gig was an IT manager for a small company. And so I work with these departments that implement their systems. I've worked with customer data and billing data. So I've got a long career of dealing with business data and business issues and processes.
Right. So you're not just some kid from the street trying to be a wise guy.
No, it's amazing. At this last meeting, we tried to get people to acknowledge a conflict of interest, and they're like, "Well, I can decide for myself." And I'm like, "That's not how this works." I've worked for AT&T, Sterling Commerce, IBM, Ashland, Valvoline. Every year, you are required to take a conflict of interest class, so you know what it is. And just because you might be a good person doesn't mean that a conflict of interest doesn't affect you. So even teaching these people basic principles has been a rough go as well.
Hey, well, Jim, thank you very much for coming on the Ohio Star podcast, and look forward to talking to you again, and I'll see you at the next meeting.
Great. Appreciate it. And, looking forward to everybody's help with us at this election to really make a difference on the Central Committee and the Republican Party.
Georgia Republican Congressman Jody Heiss is a member of the House Freedom Caucus. But more importantly, right now, he is challenging Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger for the Republican nomination. Heiss has some wind at his back, particularly from President Donald J. Trump, who has endorsed Heiss. And Heiss has also become sort of the leader of the frustrated people in Georgia who are still wondering what happened in 2020 and how can we stop it from fixing it next time. Here's my conversation with Heiss.
Hey, sir, could you talk about what it's like to have the president, the Trump wind at your back as you take on this campaign?
Yeah, listen, everyone knows that President Trump is the most powerful voice in the Republican Party nationwide, and to have the blessing of an endorsement from him is incredibly powerful in every way, and particularly here in Georgia, he has tremendous favorability in the state of Georgia, and President Trump is he's a powerful force, and I'm extremely pleased and honored to have his endorsement to become the next Secretary of State.
Sir, could you just talk about the frustration? You know, you're in Congress, you're dealing with this thing in Washington, you got all this stuff going on, and having to look over your shoulder at what's going on in Georgia when the election went down, you know, you weren't in a position to really do something about it beyond, you know, voting to certify or not certify, but you couldn't put your hands on the wheel. Can you sort of talk about that frustration?
Yeah, it is. It was a very frustrating thing. Of course, I've been fighting against the Democratic attempts to take over our elections on the federal level for over 2 years now, as they've been pushing bills like H.R. 1, H.R. 4, literally a federal takeover of our elections. And so we've been in the middle of that battle for sure. But what went down in Georgia, of course, that's a state issue. And it's it was very frustrating having had conversations with Brad Raffensperger. In fact, actually having called him to be a witness to a briefing that we had, having been watching and keeping a very close pulse on what was happening in Georgia, but being incapable of being able to do anything about it was extremely frustrating. And, you know, that is part of the drive that has brought me to the decision that the dismal performance of Brad Raffensperger and what he did to the election process in Georgia is inexcusable, and someone needs to challenge him and take him out. And I believe that I'm the most qualified one to do that. And I'm looking forward to being able to do something about the horrible decisions he has made to reverse them and to bring election integrity and confidence back to the Georgia, their votes back.
What do you think is the reason why he's been such a stonewall when it comes to any kind of serious inquiry into what happened? He just seems dead set. He's like, this is the hill I'm going to die on. No matter what comes out of Fulton County, no matter what comes out of the different affidavits, the guy just seems to just dig in his heels, and he won't even entertain that something went wrong.
Yeah. And obviously, I cannot crawl inside his brain and figure out what he's thinking or why he's making some of the decisions that he has made, but it is inexcusable for the Secretary of State not to investigate all the complaints and allegations that have come to his office, be it about the Dominion machines or any other thing. But we're at a point that our election process is no longer trusted by a large percentage of voters in Georgia because of the horrible decisions that Raffensperger has made. And there's no accountability, there seems, be it from the fraudulent activity in a place like Fulton County to even in the Secretary of State's office, where they have refused to do their job. And here we have citizen organizations that have been coming up literally doing the job of our elected officials, doing the job of our Secretary of State, that the jobs that he himself has refused to do. And that's why he needs to be replaced. But why he has refused, I think there's probably many reasons that I cannot answer, but I think he has been afraid of Stacey Abrams, afraid of a lawsuit from her. I believe that was the motivation factor for him to begin the process. And I say that because that's what he told us actually when he was a witness at a hearing we had in Oversight Committee.
And last question, sir, and I appreciate you doing this. I know you've got a tight schedule, but just sort of talk about the campaign. What parts of the state are you going to, and what are people telling you when you're done speaking and they sort of grab you by the arm? What are those things that they just are desperate to let you know?
Listen, we are receiving just incredible reception and favor all across the state. We have just finished a statewide fly-around tour. We've been to every region and major cities and smaller cities all across the state. And the basic reaction has been the same: utter disgust at Brad Raffensperger and what he has done to our election process in Georgia. And then on the other side of the same coin is incredible hope that we have an alternative, someone who will stand for the rule of law, who will stand and fight for election integrity and to restore confidence to the voters of Georgia, someone who will go after and refer prosecution to those who violate our election laws, and someone who will stand up to the Biden administration and the Biden Justice Department, who's trying to overrun our elections on the federal level. And so, I've just seen over and over and over great disgust for Brad Raffensperger and great hope and encouragement and support for us being in this race. And it's a very humbling position to be in. And I just am deeply blessed and grateful for the enormous support, the outpouring of support that we've received all across the state of Georgia.
Congressman, I really appreciate your time, and I hope to catch up with you. I'm based in D.C. with the Star News Network, which includes the Georgia Star News, in Tennessee and Ohio, and there's about 11 other sites. But obviously, we're very active in Georgia, and we're partnered with John Fredericks, and I'd look forward to catching up with you with maybe a sit down in the next weeks or so when I'm back in D.C.
Likewise, don't hesitate to reach out. I look forward to seeing you. Thank you for all that you do. It's great.
Kate, before we hang up, was there something else you wanted to make sure that the congressman said before we wrap up?
No, I think y'all covered it.
Fantastic. Kate, I'm very grateful for you making this work. I really appreciate it.
And I appreciate your flexibility. I'm sorry we had to move it the first time.
Yeah, I was going to say that too. Thanks for being flexible. It's been, D.C. is upside down right now. And, thanks for being flexible enough.
I saw Chip Roy's tweet to McCarthy saying, I'm going to object to every procedure from now to the end of time. I was like, oh, no, here we go.
I love it. I love it. You know, yesterday was quite a day, and I made the motion to adjourn to start with, and that just
tailspin.
Yeah, put him in a tailspin for about 5.5 hours.
Give me the details. So you put in the motion to adjourn, and basically you called it the MTA, and how much did that save the taxpayers?
$15 billion at the end of the day. The Democrats went back, and they were in utter, absolute disarray all day long. In fact, yesterday was supposed to begin their conference retreat. They had to cancel yesterday, which I was grateful for because they had a drag queen as their entertainment for last night. So it was good that at least we spared that as well. But no, they went back and they ended up pulling out about $15 billion. Of course, it's still $1.5 trillion of mostly unnecessary radical left-wing spending. But we were able to save the taxpayers about $15 billion just by offering the motion to adjourn.
Well, God love you, sir. And thanks a lot, Kate. I really appreciate it. Take care, guys.
Thank you for joining me on the Ohio Star podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our weekly programs that drop Thursdays. And also, please remember to leave a positive review on iTunes or wherever you are hearing me now, because it helps other people find the podcast. I am Reporter McCabe on Twitter, and you can send me news tips at neilwmccabe@thestarnewsnetwork.com. Until next time, this is Neil W. McCabe reporting for the Ohio Star.